Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Every Earl Has a Silver Lining by Anna Markland. Narrated by Cornell Collins. Twist of Fate. Island of St. Helena, 1816. My cousin's death has sealed my fate. Lieutenant Colonel Gabriel Smith reluctantly confessed to his Batman. Standing beside him on the wind-swept clifftop, Corporal Bradley remained silent, though the faithful servant must be hoping he would be sent back to England with his master. What career soldier wouldn't want to escape the thankless duty of playing nursemaid to Napoleon Bonaparte on a godforsaken rock in the middle of the South Atlantic? The regimental commander has always resented the respect I've earned from the men. He's been looking for an excuse to send me home, though I trust he doesn't know about the convulsions. Bradley grimaced. Sir, I hope you don't think... Gabe held up a hand. No, I know your loyalty. In any case, my unexpectedly inheriting an earldom means he can be rid of me without jumping through military hoops. His Batman squared his always rigid shoulders. I'll have to get used to addressing you as my lord, sir. Strophe, man, he replied. A title is something I never aspired to. The earldom of Farnworth has been in the Crompton family since the 12th century. It's incredible I've inherited the title, and I'm not sure I want it. I'm a second cousin twice removed, for heaven's sake. I've never even been to the estate in Lancashire. The original castle is apparently a ruin, and the manor house was built hundreds of years ago. It's probably crumbling and will likely need a tremendous amount of capital investment. Still, sir, my lord, you're better off getting away from here, Bradley replied. This climate will kill the best of men. Looking out at endless miles of grey ocean in every direction, Gabe doubted moving to a drafty old house in northern England was the solution to the deteriorating state of his health. He had a deep-seated suspicion his worsening malady had nothing to do with the weather. I'm not dead yet, old chap. Bradley studied his feet. What I meant, sir, is you'll feel better once you're back in Blighty, especially now the war's over and we've got the little corporal wrapped up nice and tight here. Gabriel inhaled the salty air, hoping to ward off a premonition that another embarrassing fainting spell was imminent. Unlike the men in his battalion, he'd initially welcomed the stark beauty and isolation of the island of St. Helena. It was a place to forget his fiancée's betrayal with his best friend. But his heart was still as barren and bleak as the rock on which he stood. What little news filtered through from England spoke of thousands being thrown out of work now that Napoleon was no longer a threat. The victory at Waterloo had brought an end to the war effort. One thing about war, he mused aloud, it's good for the economy. Bradley didn't react, probably used to his commanding officer's nonsensical outbursts by now. Gabe gripped the hilt of his sword. It was time to face reality. Jackson has already appointed a new battalion commander as my replacement. I'll get started packing then, shall I, sir? Yes. Although, who knows when the next Navy ship will put in? Expected in a fortnight, sir. Gabe chuckled. Bradley had clearly been anticipating their departure, but he would never ask for any favours. He was too proud, too much of a stickler for form. By the by, I've requested you be allowed to accompany me, since I don't intend to resign my commission just yet. His Batman drew himself up to his full 5-foot-nothing height and saluted. Thank you, sir. I'll get cracking. Left alone on the chilly hilltop, Gabe took a last look at the sparse trees clinging to the cliffs, all bent to the will of the relentless wind. Earl Gabriel Smith, he muttered. Ridiculous. At the age of 26, he'd spent 10 years in the army. It was the only world he knew. The prospect of taking on the responsibilities a title brought with it churned his gut. However, an inner voice whispered it was of little consequence. The mysterious ailment that had taken hold of his body would likely kill him before the year was out. Trapped. Emma Crompton set aside the tea strainer and offered the cup of Twining's Pekoe to her sister, hoping Priscilla wouldn't notice the rattle of the Sèvres porcelain cup in the matching saucer.
"Matthew's death has sealed my fate," she lamented. "I am no longer the Countess of Farnworth. I must be gone from Thicketford Manor before the new Earl arrives. He won't wish to be burdened with me and my child. I should have moved out months ago."
Seated on the rosewood and brass-inlaid sofa, Priscilla smoothed a hand over the stripes of the pale blue upholstery and leaned forward to accept the tea.
"You'll miss all this," she said with a hint of envy,
her eyes roving over the walnut sideboard, the works by Rubens and Rembrandt, and the champagne silk draperies flanking the tall windows. Her gaze finally came to rest on her sister's chinoiserie tea caddy.
"I will,"
Emma conceded, swallowing the bitterness in her throat. She'd grown used to the plush warmth of Axminster carpets underfoot.
"But we'll manage."
"You're welcome to come live with us at Bradshaw House," Priscilla replied after some hesitation. "Although, the dog..."
It was a generous offer, but an impractical one.
"I thank you, sister. But your home is barely big enough for you and your family, and I'd prefer to stay in Lancashire."
She refrained from adding that Priscilla's socialist husband wouldn't welcome her. Warren had no time for the idle rich, though Emma thought his attitude was born of jealousy. As well, the prospect of living with six unruly nephews was enough to fray anyone's nerves, and Emma craved peace. She loved her sister, though they'd never been close. However, Priscilla had no control over her sons. Her husband encouraged their misbehaviour. "Boys will be boys," he was fond of saying. The holy terrors would likely pick on Emma's shy 7-year-old daughter. Patsy hadn't yet fully grasped the reality her father wasn't coming back, and hadn't spoken a word since the funeral. She carried her toy poodle around everywhere she went. Strangely enough, the normally temperamental Wellington didn't object. Patsy didn't need to be bullied by six cousins. And Priscilla clearly didn't want a poodle in a house ruled by Warren's three mastiffs.
"So, where will you go?" her sister asked,
her voice betraying relief the offer of shelter had been declined. Since her husband's untimely death, Emma had thought long and hard on the matter. Her mother and father had sold their comfortable home and were presently touring India, spending freely on what they called their golden years. The one thing the two sisters could agree on was that their parents had lost their minds. Emma loved her suite of rooms at Thicketford Manor. Matthew's father had spared no expense in his efforts to modernize parts of the centuries-old structure. She'd never cared for the depressing green decor the old Earl had chosen for the master's chambers. But her bedroom and boudoir were beautifully decorated. The pale yellow walls offered sorely needed solace. Since Matthew's demise, she hadn't ventured through the door connecting her bedchamber to his. Too many memories lingered there. Soon, another man would lie in the enormous four-poster bed draped with dark green velvet curtains, where she'd surrendered her virginity to her handsome husband. She recalled the experience as akin to being cocooned in an underwater grotto. Patsy was fond of the nursery and her governess, but still sought the consolation of her mother's chamber at night. The legalities of Matthew's estate hadn't yet been settled in the 7 months since the accident that had taken his life. Neither of them had expected him to die so young. As a consequence, he hadn't paid the attention he perhaps should have to the disbursement of his holdings. Emma didn't blame him. The estate's battery of lawyers kept assuring her she wouldn't be penniless when all the documentation was sorted. The oft-repeated phrase caused her to doubt she'd end up with sufficient funds to keep Miss Ince employed. It was a miracle the elderly spinster had stayed on, though Emma suspected she had nowhere else to go. Hired on as a nanny when Patsy was born, the retired schoolteacher had been persuaded to take on the role of governess as well.
I suppose I could purchase a cottage,
she sighed in answer to Priscilla's question. The daughter of a prosperous spinning mill owner, Emma had unexpectedly married into the nobility and achieved wealth beyond her wildest imaginings. At first, she'd been somewhat offended by Thicketford's overwhelming opulence and grandeur, but had to admit she'd become accustomed to living in a magnificent house with a fabled history. The Farnworth estate should have been Patsy's birthright. Her son would have inherited his father's lands and titles. Instead, the prize had fallen into the lap of some distant relative no one had ever heard of, a soldier of all things. Generations of Crompton ancestors must be twisting in the family vault. The earldom of Farnworth might never recover. Emma clenched her jaw, painfully aware it would be pointless to confide her resentments to her envious sister. Summoning the cool exterior Matthew had taught her to adopt, she lifted the teapot.
More tea, dearest.
Passing her cup for a refill, Priscilla took Emma completely off guard.
Have you thought of marrying again?
Emma admitted inwardly she dreaded the prospect of a lonely widow's life, but Matthew hadn't been dead a year.
I'll pretend I didn't hear that, sister dear, she replied, handing back the cup and saucer. I'm not out of mourning for my husband. Still, Priscilla continued undaunted, when the year is up, I'm sure you could find some eligible bachelor to take you on. That fellow from the neighbouring estate who came to the funeral, for example.
Emma's stomach turned over.
Arthur Coleman? Yes, isn't he the son of Baron Whiteside? He seemed very solicitous of your welfare at the reception after the funeral.
Emma had to put her teacup down on the side table, lest she toss the contents at her sister.
The wretch tried to proposition me with my husband not 5 minutes in his grave. Oh, I think you must be mistaken. He seemed an honourable sort, and very handsome.
Emma snorted.
Priscilla never did have any inkling when it came to men. Witness the skinflint she'd married.
Arthur Coleman is a ne'er-do-well. Even Matthew recognised him for what he is, a wastrel who is frittering away his father's wealth at an alarming rate.
Still, he's the heir to the Whiteside barony, isn't he? I know you're a countess, but beggars can't be choosers, my dear. You could do worse than marry a baron.
Emma laughed out loud, sounding mildly hysterical even to her own ears.
Oh, yes, she replied bitterly. Why not plan to marry the Smith person who's inherited what should have been Patsy's?
Sticking out her little finger at an exaggerated angle, Priscilla sipped her tea.
Don't be silly. You can't marry someone with a name like Smith.
Emma closed her eyes, vowing to avoid moving in with her sister at all costs. Low Expectations. During the tedious ceremony to hand over command of his battalion to a snooty young officer named Smithhurst, Gabe thankfully managed to salute at all the appropriate times and remain upright, despite the best efforts of the bitter wind. Dismissed by his commanding officer, he boarded the tender that would take him out to HMS Dreadnought, moored in Rupert's Bay. His feelings were mixed. He was relieved he hadn't made a complete cake of himself by convulsing at the feet of Colonel Jackson. Nor was it his problem that Bonaparte's acerbic tongue would quickly whittle Smethurst down to size. However, Dreadnought hardly seemed auspicious for the journey he was about to undertake. The ship was a relatively new, second-rate 98-gun ship of the line, launched in 1801, according to the midshipman who greeted Gabe after he'd been piped aboard. He barely listened to his young guide's narrative as he was escorted to his quarters. His belly churned at the prospect of weeks of seasickness. He'd never been a good sailor, even in times of robust good health. A scant year ago, during the 10-week voyage to St. Helena aboard HMS Northumberland, he'd kept up his men's spirits. Many were disgruntled at the duty imposed on them. The rank and file, and even some non-commissioned officers, complained they hadn't signed up to watch over an arrogant Frenchman on an uninhabited island in the middle of nowhere. Gabe didn't blame them, but St. Helena was as far as he could get from the feckless Georgina plant, and he'd looked forward to the isolation. He'd enjoyed the voyage, despite occasional seasickness. Thankfully, he hadn't been directly responsible for the infamous prisoner. The portly Corsican spent much of his time on deck, leaning with his arse propped against the barrel of a 32-pounder, staring out to sea. Even in gale-force winds, the bicorn stayed firmly wedged on his head, almost covering his eyes. It became a standard jest among the men that the hat must be nailed on. Boney stood motionless for so long that Major Ibbotson was able to render several watercolour drawings of him. Perhaps the Emperor was reliving dreams of past glory and the nightmare of defeat at Waterloo. Gabe had fought on the side of the victors, and would never forget the horror of Waterloo either. "Give the little corporal his due, though," Bradley had remarked. "His uniform is always spotless, and the gold braid shines like new." "Small wonder, given the army of servants and retainers he's been allowed to bring," had been Gabe's usual reply. As the dreadnought weighed anchor, Gabe acknowledged he wouldn't miss the isolation. It hadn't healed his heart, nor soothed his resentment. Thicketford Manor might turn out to be a medieval ruin, but it was still a more preferable place to die than St. Helena. A man with the very ordinary English name of Smith ought to be buried in his native land. He spent most of the interminable voyage in his bunk, plagued by mal de mer, which aggravated the constant throbbing headaches. However, when he ventured on deck for fresh air, he thought the weakness in his limbs might be improving slightly. He was exhausted by the time he and Bradley disembarked HMS Dreadnought. As a senior officer, he'd been obliged to dine at the captain's table. Driscoll held forth endlessly about the ship's illustrious history, including her role in the Battle of Trafalgar. Gabe heard the tale so often he could recite it verbatim. Dreadnought was the 8th ship in the Lee Division to enter the action. She started firing on San Juan Nepomuceno at 2 o'clock, and 15 minutes later forced her to surrender after her commander was killed in action. Gabe didn't begrudge Driscoll his pride in the vessel he commanded. However, as he stood on the Bristol dock and inhaled the air of his native land, he acknowledged with a chuckle that he could probably recite the whole blooming history of the ship from the day she was launched. His amusement was short-lived. There was something about the air in Bristol that smelled. The ever-efficient Bradley thrust a kerchief into his hand just in time as he sneezed, then sneezed again. "What is that smell?" he asked his batman after blowing his nose. "It's making my eyes water." Bradley stuck out his chin and inhaled deeply. "Good old blighty. Nothing like it, eh, sir?" Gabe hadn't remembered the air in England being so pungent, but supposed his nose was used to salty Atlantic sea breezes, and Bristol was an industrial city as well as a port. He'd planned to make his way north without delay, but Driscoll invited him to stay at his home in the town for a day or two. While it meant listening ad nauseam to the stories about Dreadnought, a comfortable bed would renew his energy for the trek to Lancashire. In any case, it wasn't likely anyone at Thicketford Manor was eagerly awaiting his arrival. Gripping the brief missive handed to her on a silver tray by the butler, Emma gritted her teeth. "I suppose this explains the delay," she huffed.
"My lady,"
Frame acknowledged with his usual deferential bow. The man had served the Crompton household for longer than she'd been alive. He trained all new staff, keeping on only those who met his high standards. His word among the servants was law, but he never bullied. A softly spoken reprimand or a raised eyebrow was all it took to keep them in line. There was nothing she could do to ensure the butler was retained, and hoped the new earl recognized the treasure he had inherited. Upon first noting the letter had come from her husband's solicitors after months fretting about the uncertain future she and her daughter faced, she'd assumed it contained news of the monies left to her. A lack of funds had rendered it impossible to make arrangements for alternative accommodations. It seemed increasingly likely they'd be forced to lodge with Priscilla for a short while at least. The prospect only tightened the knot in her stomach. Her heart lurched when she reread the letter she'd only scanned briefly.
According to this, the new Earl's ship, HMS Dreadnought, for goodness sake, docked in Bristol a week ago, and he intended to proceed here forthwith. But it has taken the lawyers 3 days to get word to us. The man might arrive any day. And where on earth is St. Helena?
I believe it's a barren, uninhabited rock in the Atlantic Ocean, m'lady,
Frame replied.
Napoleon Bonaparte was exiled there after his defeat at Waterloo.
A chill stole up Emma's spine. She recalled hearing something of the sort and couldn't imagine the British Army posting its best officers to the middle of nowhere. Gabriel Smith might be a lieutenant colonel, but her expectations of him weren't high. It seems anyone can buy a commission these days, she muttered.
Quite, my lady,
Frame agreed.
All is in readiness for his arrival. However, might I suggest the maids move your belongings to another chamber, perhaps on the attic floor for the time being. It's my understanding the new Earl has no wife, but...
Emma felt like an idiot. Of course she couldn't stay in the suite of rooms adjoining the master's bedchamber. She wondered if grief and fear would ever loosen their paralyzing grip on her wits. Thank you, Frame, she said as she rose from the blue sofa. I'll sorely miss your wisdom. This is a good time for me to oversee the move, while Patsy is with Miss Ince in the nursery.
As you wish, my lady.
Changes. Emma sat stiffly in the wooden rocking chair in the claustrophobic attic chamber, thankful Patsy had finally fallen asleep in her lap. Her daughter had wailed fretfully, not understanding why she couldn't sleep in the usual place. Only after Emma allowed Wellington to curl up with them had the child calmed. Her back ached, but she didn't dare move. Another weeping session would severely test the floodgates of her own sorrow. A yapping poodle might tempt her to violence. It would take some time to get used to sharing the small bedroom with her daughter. Before her father had made his fortune, she and her sister had shared a bed. The memory wasn't a pleasant one. However, Patsy certainly wasn't the bully Priscilla had been. Emma consoled herself with the promise the situation would only be temporary, as soon as the solicitors sorted out the will. However, a child couldn't be expected to comprehend such matters, especially one who hadn't spoken since her father's funeral. The attic chambers, intended originally to accommodate the master's valet and the mistress's Abigail, were tucked under the eaves. The ceiling that sloped alarmingly on either side of the bed was already closing in. Emma had a phobia of enclosed spaces, and dreaded waking during the first night feeling trapped in new surroundings. The tiny armoire and mismatched set of two drawers were completely inadequate for all the items in her wardrobe. Poor Lucy had heaped the overflow on top of the only other chair. The light grey walls badly needed repainting, and the once plush Axminster area rug was threadbare in places. Used to her own private boudoir, she wasn't looking forward to traipsing across the hallway to the shared facilities, though Frame had assured her the other bedroom had been vacant since the valet's departure for another position. Her Abigail had been packed off to the servants' wing, a move Lucy would likely consider a demotion. It wasn't to Emma's credit that she had never realized her personal maid slept in what amounted to a cupboard in the attic. She ought to be grateful the butler had also made sure the room was spotlessly clean and aired. She was confident the bed linens would be crisp, the pillows soft, and the blankets warm. On the morrow, she'd mention the need for a mirror.
"We'll just have to make the best of it,"
she whispered to her sleeping child, hoping she had the fortitude to bear the presence of the usurper who was due to arrive any day.
the only course of action would be for her and Patsy to avoid this Smith person completely. Gabe enjoyed the first few hours of the journey north. The air smelled fresher once they left Bristol behind. The scenery was very different from St. Helena. Mile after mile of verdant fields, English oaks, wide, lazy rivers and tidy farmhouses. He began to feel he really was back home. It was years since he'd read any of Blake's poetry, but England's green and pleasant land played over and over in his head. The coach was well-sprung and reasonably comfortable, if chilly. The other passengers, who boarded and disembarked at various coaching houses en route, seemed disinclined to engage in conversation, for which Gabe was grateful. It seemed the year without a summer had soured everyone's mood. Bradley made sure their bits of luggage were secure in the boot before cheerfully climbing up top behind the guard and driver. No doubt he intended to talk the men's ears off with tales of Napoleon. It was as well Gabriel had followed his Batman's advice and travelled in uniform. They were treated with respectful deference in the coaching inns and provided with clean accommodations, vermin-free linens and, occasionally, complimentary food. He suspected Bradley of putting it about that the officer he served had fought at Waterloo. It was unlikely his servant would have mentioned his own bravery on that bloody battlefield. He wasn't sure at what point he became aware of the troubling numbers of ragged men begging in the streets of the larger towns they passed through, some of them amputees. The rumours of widespread destitution after the collapse of the wartime economy were evidently true. It churned his gut to see soldiers who'd sacrificed limbs, having to beg for their bread. He was more grateful than ever that he and Bradley had survived the carnage unscathed. If only that held true for all the men under his command. His optimism eroded further as they ventured into the industrial heartland of the nation. By the time the coach dropped them at the Punch Bowl Inn in Manchester, the fetid air had made breathing difficult. The autumn sun that might have burned off the fog was obliterated by the effects of the volcanic winter it seemed the whole world was enduring. The incessant wind had spared St. Helena, though the island was never what one might call warm. He hoped Thicketford Manor was located in a greener, more bucolic part of Lancashire. His chamber was cramped, but clean and well supplied with towels, a ewer and basin and a small set of drawers. He'd slept in worse, and it was only for the one night. The dining room proved to be busy and too noisy. Born in the south of England, Gabe found the northern brogue difficult to understand. It seemed northerners were also less inhibited about other folks overhearing their conversation than their southern countrymen. After a passable meal of lamb chops, potatoes and gravy, he extricated himself from the cacophony and retired to his chamber. He slept fairly well considering the drunken revelry that went on below for hours. The next morning, having forced down a couple of fried eggs, he was studying a substance on his breakfast plate the pimple-faced waiter had informed him was black pudding, when Bradley approached and saluted. "Morning, sir!" It might be Gabe's imagination, but his Batman seemed to have an even stiffer ramrod up his backside than usual. Perhaps the man was also apprehensive about their imminent arrival at Thicketford Manor. "There's no need to salute me," he muttered, shoving the black pudding away from his queasy stomach. "We're not on duty."
"Sir!"
Bradley replied, clicking his heels and remaining at attention.
"Thought you'd like to know I've procured nags to take us to the solicitor's office."
Gabe wasn't feeling remotely well enough to organize transport. Indeed, the prospect of keeping his appointment with the solicitors charged with overseeing the earldom's finances filled him with dread. They'd know as soon as they met him he wasn't up to the task. However, the ever-dependable Bradley had simply gone ahead and taken care of the matter. "Good man," he said, relieved. Yet unreasonably irritated, he would need to rely more and more on his servant as his illness progressed. The Will. It felt good to be back on a horse, though the gelding Bradley had rented from the stables was old and docile. Gabe hadn't ridden on St. Helena.
His world there had consisted of long hours spent in Napoleon's cottage and the compound surrounding it. He nursed a hope the stables at Thicketford housed a few good steeds, until his conscience reminded him any fine horseflesh he might have inherited had come to him only by dint of his cousin's death.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?